Good afternoon, and welcome to this webinar, The Recipe for Successful New Product Development. This event, brought to you by Beverage Industry, is sponsored by Cargill and Brothers International. I'm your moderator, Jessica Jacobson, editor of Beverage Industry. Thanks for joining us. Before we get started, I'd like to share a few words from our sponsors. With nearly 3/4 of consumers saying they always have a beverage in hand, the category's impact on consumers' daily lives can't be overstated. From energy to hydration, mood support to flavor exploration, the possibilities are endless and the bar is high. Cargill collaborates with beverage developers to create groundbreaking new beverages that deliver on trends, satisfy label expectations, and most importantly, taste great. Today's presenters are Joan Driggs, Vice President of Content and Thought Leadership with Circana, James Weiss, Managing Director with Big Drop Incorporated, and Jake Bullock, Co-Founder and CEO of Can Social Tonics. Don't forget to submit your questions, and later in the program, our presenters will address as many as possible. Today's event is being recorded and archived on www.bevindustry.com. And now I'm excited to turn it over to today's first presenter, Joan Driggs.
Thanks for having me back, Jessica. This is the 29th year for New Product Pacesetters, which provides a pulse on innovation and the key themes they identify about changing consumer behavior. It's important to call out that these products may have been developed before 2023, likely in 2022 or 2021. And let's face it, a lot changed during those years. That the products that I'm going to show you today did so well in 2023 speaks volumes about launch plans and execution. I'll highlight how different sized companies were able to break through with innovation. There's definitely some interesting twists there. And I'll of course reveal the top 10 pacesetters across food and beverage. And I'll show you some more recent launches that are rising stars and the consumer behaviors that they point to. Pacesetters include the top 100 selling food and beverage and top 100 selling non-food CPG items. A little background on New Product Pacesetters methodology. These new brands work hard to achieve pacesetter status. To qualify as a pacesetter, products must reflect a new or extended brand, and line extensions have to be transformative, taking a product into a new format or space. Once a product achieves 30% distribution within total U.S. MULO or multi-outlet, we start the clock on the launch period for year one, and we track it for 13 quad weeks. And the product needs to maintain that distribution with at least 30% distribution at the end of the year one timeframe. So these new products reflect the best of the best in terms of sales achievement. In their respective year one, which all closed in 2023. Collectively, these 200 products, they represent just 1% of total store sales, but they drove 18% of store growth. So a small share, but with a significant contribution to sales. And this is why Pacesetters matter. There were some exciting, there was an exciting mix of Pacesetters in 2023. And as we considered some of the common threads and underlying shifts in consumer behavior, five key themes emerged. Today, I'm just going to talk about two of them, breakfast at home and added benefits, both of which speak to innovation occurring in the beverage space. A full new product Pacesetters report is available for free download at Circana.com. Just go to Insights and Reports. You'll see that especially within keeping breakfast at home, many Pacesetter products were impacted by consumers' return to full mobility following the pandemic, whether that was settling into hybrid work or resuming social and family activities. Within the breakfast space, these new retail products tapped into a lot of the trends that we observed at quick service restaurants, delivering new levels of convenience for busy lives. And added benefits, which really showcases beverage innovation, is also seeing a bump from new functional and performance benefits, many of which are serving as category disruptors, going beyond energy and hydration in the beverage space. Breakfast foods had a strong showing this year, with 12 breakfast solutions making the Pacesetter list for 2023. Sourcing breakfast food from retail is way more affordable than purchasing from restaurants. And Pacesetter products demonstrated that CPG companies are committed to offering the same trends that QSRs benefited from in 2023, including convenience, portability, adventurous flavors, healthier options, and notably coffee. Circana's National Eating Trends data reveals that breakfast occasions at quick service restaurants grew in 2023 and in large part were driven by purchases of specialty coffee. Starbucks by Nespresso for Vertuo found a way to keep that coffee occasion in the home with its new coffee and espresso pods. Danone, maker of International Delight Creamer, decided it could also make a better coffee and extended its brand of creamers to include iced coffees. This kind of goes with our brands reimagined, but I'm really sticking with breakfast here. Carnation Breakfast Essentials leveraged Kellogg's cereal trademarks, including Fruit Loops, Frosted Flakes, and Rice Krispie Treats, to give consumers a familiar flavor in a nutritionally balanced portable breakfast. I talk about convenience a lot, but consumers are looking for more than convenience, especially last year with all the record inflation. Wherever consumers are spending their money, they want to make sure that they're getting a good value, and that can mean benefits. We know that consumers look for ease and positive results. They want added benefits without any extra work on their part. These added benefits might come in the form of professional level results, or in products that deliver more nutritional or fast-acting benefits. Hydration has been a big buzzword in beverages, and products like Gatorlyte and Prime Hydration, and even Gatorade Fit for post-workout hydration, speak to the 43% of consumers looking for more hydration benefits to alleviate headaches, muscle cramps, and more. BioSteel hits a number of hot buttons with zero sugar hydration powders with electrolytes and added vitamins and minerals. Their tagline is clean, healthy hydration with no caffeine. Notable within those breakfast Pacesetters is extending brands into new spaces and occasions. But here I want to talk about transforming existing categories. Both Olipop and Poppi bring new levels of nutrition to conventional carbonated soft drinks. Olipop features plant fiber and probiotics in classic soda flavors, such as root beer and cola. The brand has also leaned into social influencers to promote the product, even as it continues to innovate with new flavors. The brand made a splash in 2023 to coincide with the Barbie movie, launching Olipop Barbie Peaches and Cream. Pappy, a prebiotic soda, is made with fruit juice and apple cider vinegar. It was founded by a husband and wife duo, and it got its start at farmers markets, eventually landing support from Shark Tank. Early marketing focused on TikTok and social influencers, getting some love from the likes of Post Malone, Hailey Bieber, Kylie Jenner, Billie Eilish, and more. When they were launching in 7-Eleven, their display looked like a store within a store, with Pappy slushies and Pappy merch, so an Instagram-worthy launch strategy. And Athletic is one of the top-selling non-alcoholic beers in the U.S., and its Run Wild IPA, with just 65 calories, addresses the changing behaviors of young adults who are not consuming as much alcohol as previous generations. But these beers really lean into, like, the hops and malts language of other craft beers. So innovation showed up in different shapes and sizes in 2023, keeping both consumers and retailers engaged. But this year, small players were really the winner. While Circana saw strong growth contributions from mid-sized companies last year, the 2023 pace setters reflect the power of smaller companies with sales less than 500 million, and in particular, from manufacturers with sales less than 100 million. Manufacturers with sales less than 500 million, shown in those light gray bars, represent 59% of new product pace setters by count, up from 41% in 2022. And these smaller companies also made a big impact on dollar sales, delivering a combined 43% of new product pace setter dollars, up from just 18% in 2022. The smaller company success story is also heavily anchored in compelling and memorable brand stories. Black Rifle Coffee, a company founded and fueled by military veterans, was started in the garage of founder Evan Hafer, an ex-Army Green Beret, who roasted his own coffee beans during his military career. The company supports and celebrates those who have served, with the founders initially promoting the business largely through online viral videos to drive awareness. Black Rifle isn't about driving mass appeal. It was about understanding the consumer, and that really proved to be super beneficial because they sold directly to those consumers during the pandemic when, frankly, brick and mortar was not the way to launch the products. D2C success eventually enabled a move into retail with the ready-to-drink coffee, which was quickly followed by coffee pods, ground coffee, and whole bean offerings. With many of the ready-to-drink varieties coming in at 300 milligrams of caffeine per serving, it's one of the most caffeine-dense drinks on the market. The Ghost Energy story focused on feel-good energy, elevating the energy and caffeine level, but doing it in a transparent way with authentic flavors and zero sugar. The brand tapped into popular confection brands such as Swedish Fish, Sour Warhead, Sour Patch Kids, and Bubblicious to deliver a nostalgic and fun experience, along with some special edition releases. Ghost has a number of partnerships spanning music festivals, sports teams, and gaming, and they also serve as a sponsor of various fitness events, helping to build the brand and generate trial. And Liquid Death is not what it seems at first blush. The branding and packaging evokes amped up energy, or even a new brand of beer. There are reports of parents frantically calling their teen kids when they see Instagram pictures of their child holding a can of what they think is an alcoholic beverage or an energy drink. Never has bottled, or in this case canned water, generated this much buzz. Liquid Death was born in part from the insight that musicians and concertgoers alike wanted to hydrate, but they didn't want to appear boring by consuming plain water. Ironically, many were pouring water into empty energy drink cans to address that stigma. The brand's founder realized that there was an opportunity to take branding and bottled water to a completely new level, creating the tagline, "Murder Your Thirst," with Liquid Death leaning into edgy and humorous marketing and some mock ads to drive brand engagement. The use of the can is also purposeful, in part because it's greener, and the company uses the tagline, "Death to Plastic." And keep in mind that, again, we've seen that increase in non-alcoholic beverages, along with the sober curious trend. So here's the top 10 food and beverage pace setters from 2023. And before I dig into the rankings, I just want to call your attention to some of the data on the screen, because there's really a lot packed in here. And hopefully you can come back to this deck for a closer look. But Vivix provided the data on traditional media dollar spent for broadcast advertising, print, and major digital programs. We also pulled in Circana's trial and repeat data. And all in, it really tells an interesting story of go-to-market strategies and marketing commitment. Typically with media spend, we have some brands that are spending tens of millions of dollars to promote their new products. This year, our top spender is Starry carbonated soft drink from PepsiCo, with an investment of more than $23 million. It's a new brand, so it makes sense that PepsiCo would want to invest in consumer education, and it worked. With just more than 11% of households trying the product, it had 46% of those households coming back for a repeat purchase, and that's really phenomenal. Food items often have higher repeat purchases because they can be consumed so quickly, but still, that's impressive. So we're going to start with Kevin's Naturals. These are clean entrees that speak to our desire for convenient taste and interesting experiences. Just 4% of triers, but a 44% repeat rate. And they only spent $4,500 on advertising. So with an $82 million return in the first year in sales, that's pretty good. Electrolit actually started in Mexico about 50 years ago as a replenishment beverage for babies. And it only recently came to the U.S. Very small media spend, just 2% of households trying, but a 65% repeat rate. Black Rifle Coffee is number 8 with $86 million in sales. Doritos Cheetos Sun Chips Minis from PepsiCo is number 7 with $104 million in sales. Notably, we had 7 food and beverage products with dollar sales above $100 million. Ghost Energy had $117 million in sales. And you can see they only spent about $4,000. That does not include all the event sponsorships that I talked about. So it's really important to look at all the strategies that these brands are employing to connect with their audience. Number 5, Starbucks by Nespresso for Virtuo with $118 million. Oreo Frozen Desserts had sales of $126 million. Number 3, Starry, the one with the big ad budget, had sales of $168 million. Number 2, Prime, again, a small company with, you know, kind of a relatively large $4 million in media spend, but a great return at $245 million. And that's just for multi-outlet. And then number 1, Similac 360 Total Care had sales of $250 million. Again, just 1% of households buying, if you think about it, babies. But 64% of those households kept coming back. And this is an interesting one, too, because this is an audience that continues to age out of the product. So I also want to call out some of the top products in the convenience channel. This is where a lot of discovery happens, not only because of the convenience of shopping, but because consumers can buy single items and you don't really have to pay for those full packs. Beverages are always top sellers. And you can see this when you visit a C-store because they've got the chilled beverage cases taking up at least a wall in the store. And this is where a lot of manufacturers choose to launch their products. This year, 9 out of our 10 C-store pace setters are beverages. So we've got number 10, Simply Spiked Lemonade from Molson Coors. had sales of 47 million following the strong sales in recent years of hard seltzers and ready-to-drink cocktails. Here we have a licensing deal with Coca-Cola's Simply Lemonade for an adult beverage that has 5% real juice. Number 9, Oreo and Frozen Novelties. Again, a smaller purchase within convenience. That's sales of nearly 49 million, but that's in addition to the 126 million in the multi-outlet channels. Number 8, Starry had sales of 49 million. Again, on top of 168 million in multi-outlet. Gator Light had sales of nearly 51 million. Liquid Death, sales of 69 million. Voodoo Ranger Juice Force Beer from Kirin Brewery had sales of 73 million. Black Rifle Coffee, remember it had sales of 86 million in multi-outlet, and here it's nearly tied at 85 million. Gatorade Fit, number 3, with 102 million. And Alani Nu, which did the reverse of what most companies do. It transitioned from multi-outlet into C-store, and it had sales of 116 million. Last year, Alani Nu beverages were number 1 in multi-outlet. And then number 1, Ghost Energy, had sales of 272 million. So, you've seen the best of the best in terms of first year sales, but interestingly, combined across food and beverage and non-food, we see that those blockbuster products, those with sales of 100 million or more, are just a small percent, just 6% of all Pacesetters. Notably, we see that 83% of Pacesetter products had sales of less than 40 million. And over the past 10 years or so, companies have really leveraged tools that help define the target audience. And companies are making the effort to get the right product to the right audience through the right marketing and sales channels. This demonstrates why it's so critical to firmly set expectations for first-year sales. You know, we've seen a lot of products that really look like they're successful to us, but they were pulled from the market because they didn't live up to sales expectations. And now I am going to turn it over to James.
Operate. Here we go.
All right. Thank you so much. My name is James. I'm the managing director of Big Drop Inc. We are a full service digital agency headquartered in New York. And when I say full service, I mean everything from branding to website design development, which is what we're really known for, as well as digital marketing. And on that note, when it comes to marketing, today, we're really going to focus on Gen Z, kind of branching off from what was just discussed into kind of drilling down into that core demographic, who they are, how they operate, what they look for. This is not an uncommon conversation for some of the clients that we work with, but visit bigdropinc.com to learn more and check out our portfolio. So as we look into the demographic by itself, typically what we find is that each generation has their own core attributes that help to kind of define them. But what's interesting about Gen Z specifically is that they're the only generation, obviously to date, that is born with the internet and lives with the internet. Something that obviously previous generations were either brought into or have a higher learning. So because they are very much digital savvy users, they understand how the world works within and without a screen. Many of the things that we advise clients on, at least from a demographic perspective when it comes to Gen Z, is really how to understand how to meet users where they're at. But the core tenets here for Gen Z may not be surprising to you, but they really are the fact that they are born within the digital age. There is a lot of anxiety that they have around climate, as well as having lived through the COVID-19 pandemic and the general changes in the financial landscape. And so what does that all mean as far as you know, how they interact with the world and what they have as far as behavior preferences. When it comes to how they operate as consumers, there are about 7 key elements that we see time and time again within this generation that kind of helps to inform our perspective about what it is that they do and how they do it. Here they are. The social media centricity is huge. Each day we're averaging about 2 hours and 55 minutes, almost 3 hours of just being on social media like TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat. This is where a lot of information is being shared. This is where a lot of users are finding themselves, are connecting with other users as well. Number two, sustainability and ethical practices. 73% of this generation is willing to spend more on product if it has that sustainability element to it. Again, reiterating that the anxiety that exists around climate change and what it means for their generation, for the longevity of their generation, for their, effective survival, that plays into the psychology of what a Gen Z consumer and how they make decisions. And then, talking about their longevity, talk about their mortality, they make more health conscious decisions, things that are a little bit more beneficial to them in totality. And the interesting statistic here, 80% of the generation actively seeks healthier food and drink options. So it's not that they are not paying attention to anything that doesn't fit that category, but they are looking for something that is going to enhance their overall experience, be beneficial for them from a health perspective, for both food and drink. And when it comes to the brands that they're looking at, the ones that they want to engage with, anything that's going to offer them the opportunity to have a personalized experience, a customized experience, is going to go the extra mile with a member of this generation. It's really less about the acquisition of material so much as it is the experience that they get from interacting with a brand or a product that is, central to who they are as a person. More so than any other generation, the individualistic nature of a Gen Z consumer is typically what is top of mind for them when they are assessing brands, when they are assessing products. And that kind of leads into number seven, of course, with the experiential element, but I'll get more into that in a sec. And then, of course, the barometer for authenticity, when it comes to assessing different brands, seeing what's out there in the marketplace, that threshold is pretty high. More often than not, someone who is looking for a specific product or is looking to engage with a certain brand, they want to know that there is a lack of brand opacity when it comes to who they are, what they stand for, and the contribution that they make to the zeitgeist, to the world in general. That speaks directly to the values that a member of Gen Z would have. The interesting statistic here, 67% of the generation believe brands should be open about their values. And the values could range, obviously. We're talking about how you view the sociopolitical climate. What opinions do you have on what's happening in the world that is directly related to things that this type of consumer cares about? The more open a brand would be here, the better shot they would have, not necessarily to pigeonhole themselves with one type of generation, but certainly to build that brand loyalty and trust at a very early point within that consumer's life cycle. Next, number six, branching off from where we were, there is a significant high value placed on trusting individuals that are part of an average consumer, Gen Z consumer's zeitgeist. So user-generated content comes into play here much more than it really has ever before, mainly because it's more accessible for Gen Z, but they're doing it themselves. They prefer to lean on trusted sources that they may have a direct connection to or that speak to them or that are relatable. So user-generated content is kind of that secret weapon that brands can employ to reach those target audience members within Gen Z. And I think a lot of that also plays towards number seven, in the sense that it's great to offer them something that is personalized, that that is uniquely for them. But at the same time, you're going to get the social media benefit out of that if they're having a great time, if they're showing how they're interacting with the brand, if they are making recommendations, product suggestions, just by virtue of what's in their life. We'll see a lot of that being used and leveraged by brands to help build their overall awareness and appeal to more of Gen Z as a generation in totality. And so, how are they really doing that? That's the next step here. So as I move through, give me one moment. The first one, kind of going back to the core principles of how brands can do, can work within what they have available to them within their marketing machines to appeal to Gen Z, leverage social media comes in at number one. What that really means is making sure that there is never a lapse in connections that are being made with anyone who would be part of a target demographic that a brand is trying to appeal to. And of course, what does that mean? That means we have to focus on the right platforms. It means we have to collaborate with influencers who are on those platforms, and of course, who have the voice of either the brand or the product or the ear of the generation that we're trying to appeal to. The user-generated content element plays right into that. And of course, you'll see this time and time again within all these slides, A/B test everything. Make sure that the actual strategy that you're putting in place is working, and test it against another variable to make sure that you can see the differences in data and the differences in performance. But going back to kind of 1.1, when we're talking about focusing on the right platforms, it's not enough to know what where your users are, but how they digest what it is that's being put forth. And so the best way to do that right now, given the platforms, given their unique kind of competitive advantages with each other, the short form snackable video content is really what Gen Z goes for. Obviously attention spans get shorter. They get shorter despite, you know, everyone's best efforts, and the attention spans tend to span other generations as well. It's not unique to Gen Z, but they are most used to consuming short snackable sized video content. So that's kind of in position 1.1 for that reason. And when you are leveraging other users on the platform in terms of being able to collaborate with them, work in partnership, a lot of times it's not necessarily the biggest influencers that have the most reach, although that is technically tried and true. But even reaching more towards the grassroots level, the ground level with micro influencers and nano influencers, the targeted approach that you would get with that tends to be very, very successful in terms of isolating a demographic or being able to appeal to that demographic in a specific location on a more targeted basis. And like I said before, UGC, user-generated content, can't live without it. Brands should do everything they possibly can to you know, help themselves market their own product by leveraging what it is that users of the product or converted consumers are already doing. If you can obviously work alongside someone who is a champion for a brand, you know, part of your work is already done. So of those three kind of core tenets within leveraging social media as a standard would be you know, that's why it's number one. As I move along, this kind of goes back to number five on the slide I showed earlier, leaning into authenticity. I think one thing that we find quite frequently is that there's a lot of noise within different markets, different companies doing the same thing, oftentimes have very similar messaging. How can we cut through the noise to make sure that there is a clear narrative that is distinct from everything else that's happening within the marketplace? And I think going back to what I mentioned before in the other slide with slide five, it's always important to be aware of how high the threshold is for authenticity. Disingenuous marketing is something that Gen Z is very aware of, partly because as marketing took a shift, you know, obviously not too long ago, to be almost exclusively digital in some cases, the amount of information that can be consumed and the way in which it's consumed allows for the barrier to be set very, very high for anything that does not conform to what is being provided as far as Gen Z is concerned. What I mean by that really is anything that doesn't appear to be brand adherent or that seems to differentiate, rather differ from what a user is normally seeing from that brand comes across as inauthentic. And it really does damage the brand's reputation in terms of how that you know, Gen Z individual interprets the brand and has that perception of that brand. Part of the way you can mitigate that is by being as transparent as possible. This means, you know, showing the process, showing everything that you stand for, not letting the narrative of the brand or the product be taken away by anyone else who is using it or is thinking about interacting with it. This really means that the more insight that can be offered into, like I was saying, product development, general production, any environmental impact and treatment of employees, these things are kind of core principles that Gen Z is going to want to see to know that they're making an informed decision by interacting with a brand, by supporting a brand that speaks to their core values. Each of the things that I've highlighted here within this particular box are all elements that make Gen Z the unique generation that they are, and the things that resonate with them the most. And I think tied into that with, of course, branching off from one and two here, distributing relatable narratives is absolutely key here. So it's not just a matter of appealing and appearing authentic or showing instead of telling, but being able to actually have the narrative that incorporates the real, the relatable people and experiences within the overall marketing strategy that's being employed. The only way to really make sure that that authenticity gets assured is by being as relatable as possible, making sure that whoever is part of the target audience is seeing themselves within the product. And of course, A/B test it. Make sure that if you're seeing things that are working from a transparency perspective, messages that you're putting forward about how you do what you do and why it's different, connected to something else that might have been that you may have as far as a brand narrative. All of those things are really important as far as the insight that you can gain from whether or not one message is working versus another. And as I move on, there are really only four elements here that I think we've distilled into seeing what's been working for Gen Z. And this is kind of what I mentioned before, because the zeitgeist is full of socioeconomic and political movements. Gen Z is listening. It's in their face every single day. It's on the screens that they're looking at. And so when you are thinking about marketing, when you are thinking about how to reach that specific type of consumer, the thing that we would advise is not to be afraid to stand on social issues. And that goes right to purpose-driven marketing. The reason why we say that is because it's better to have a clearly defined position than to have individuals guessing about what it is that you stand for. That's not to say that every brand needs to come out in support of one thing over another, but it does mean that when the audience calls upon you, or when you are in a position of needing to demonstrate what your position is, it's important to make sure that any opacity that goes alongside that could come from being afraid to take risks and being afraid to voice is not there. You could be a champion without needing to necessarily show that you support everything all the time. But the things that are important to Gen Z, like I was mentioning before, things that are around the environment, things around social causes, being able to take a stand and show that really does go the extra mile with Gen Z. They know who they're talking to. They know if they align with their core values. Things like sustainability that I mentioned before, show it, don't tell it. You can tell it, but I think it's better to show within the process how something works from a sustainability environmental perspective. And the one thing that I kind of mentioned before, but I think is really important too, is inclusivity. Inclusivity matters to Gen Z because it's that highly personalized, that individualistic nature that they have of being recognized, being seen. Brands can do wonders by showing them that they are allies, that they are able to find themselves within the brand, that the narrative incorporates room and space for them. It's always an important element, especially when appealing to Gen Z. And of course, A/B test how that works. Where you are being seen on social issues, how you interact with those social issues, and what Gen Z really requires to hear to be part of a brand experience. All of those are vital as far as whether or not you're making that connection resonate as much as possible. The last one I have to share here, personalization and interactivity. I think one of the things that we find a lot of times when a brand is looking to appeal to a very specific demographic, in this case, you know, one that is highly savvy when it comes to and that fully, on their screens, where they're going to be. One thing that we've seen more recently is gamification. A lot of times being able to interact with a brand, not for the brand's sake, not for the product, but what the brand can offer beyond that, whether it is a quiz or a poll. A lot of those elements kind of help someone in this generation understand how the brand wants to be part of their lifestyle, wants to be part of their ecosystem. And because of that, you've almost kind of purchased a little bit of life share with anyone within Gen Z, meaning that they will give you more attention the more that you can offer them an opportunity to give it. And of course, interactive content works, gamification works, put them together, figure out which one is working better, and do more of that is really the core tenet here. But not just those four components are really being put into practice unless, or worthy of being put into practice unless you can see who's doing it well and why. This may sound repetitive, but I think we found very similar data. But of course, Liquid Death for us as a brand kind of takes the cake here, especially with how they've been able to position themselves. They're humorous, they're anti-establishment branding, their focus on environmental sustainability, all of these elements that have been kind of at the foundational level of building Liquid Death as a brand, is it immediately addresses all the items that Gen Z is going to want to know and going to want to see in a brand to kind of give them the due credit to become a consumer. So the key reasons here: unconventional approach to their branding, their recyclable aluminum cans, that was mentioned before in the previous presentation. It is a healthy alternative with a twist. So that does appeal to the need to find something that is most, or rather more healthy than what their alternatives are. And the strong social media presence certainly helps. And you'll probably find that with the next example, social media is pretty much the core driver of how this brand kind of came to be. Obviously, the strong influencer power that Prime Hydration has really helped boost its brand visibility across Gen Z. This brand was basically created for this type of user in mind, and not only that, it's got the backing of well-known influencers. There's direct fan engagement, so being able to have online challenges that offer users a way to interact with the brand other than just purchasing it, taking photos with it, videos with it, and consuming it, that goes the extra mile. There is an aspirational lifestyle to Prime, being that it is hydration focused, but there is something that we're talking about something that's kind of like an energy drink. It works really, really well. And that narrative that has been spun from different influencers, not just the founders themselves, really helps connect with Gen Z. And of course, it's accessible. You can find it in quite a few different stores. It's in Costco, so you'll be able to find it and not have to go to specific outlets or specific, I would say retail establishments to be able to find it. It's easy to get your hands on. And I think the third one, these are in no particular order, by the way, but I think they do make a lot of sense for Gen Z specifically, Poppy. Because there is a health conscious nature to how Gen Z makes their purchasing decisions, a lot of the functional benefits that go alongside something like Poppy really does resonate, not to mention, the fun, colorful branding that they have as well. Being able to insert themselves into Gen Z's life through things like, as mentioned before, their collaboration with Barbie, certainly a slam dunk, a home run, a grand slam, if you will, for that time. And I think because they have a relatable origin story in terms of how they were founded, how they grew, people were able to follow the trajectory of a brand like this. In some ways, their narrative is what distinguishes them from other competitors in the space. I did want to give some honorable mentions here. Red Bull, Coca-Cola, Oatly, Topo Chico, Bang Energy, Sparkling Water, and Can and Recess have all kind of become players in the space, some of obviously legacy companies. But I think what's interesting about these is that there's kind of a diversity among the type of product. And even though there is some legacy here, it still is a matter of maintaining relevance amongst a new generation, and how that generation interacts with different types of brands in different ways, and what a brand's responsibility is to consistently revitalize its narrative, and find users where they're at. It's really kind of interesting. And it's really, I think the challenge will be how can brands continue to maintain that relevance, and how will they find new ways to appeal to target audiences, especially with emergences in technology and ways to reach users that they really haven't been available before. And that's about it. I will turn it over to you, Jake.
Thank you, Jason. My name is Jake Bullock. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Can. We make a range of infused microdose alcohol alternatives. They're infused with THC and CBD, and the brands and products are really positioned to be one-to-one substitutes for alcohol. We sell these products in a number of states, a growing number of states now, in liquor stores like Total Wine, also on DoorDash, and on our website as well, direct to consumers, I think in almost 40 states now. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time today. I'll try to go through it quickly so that, you know, we can have time for questions of all the folks, at the end, really talking about product development. And from our perspective, it can, some of the lessons and learnings that we've pulled from, you know, over the last 6 years of developing products in this emerging space, and engage with some of the ideas and issues that folks may have at that very starting point of creating products. So a little bit different than what we see at in the big CPG side, and why we think we're able to create something that feels innovative and different. We really call this values-driven product development. This is a little bit different than sort of the socio-political values that Jason highlighted that Gen Z is focused on. We're really talking about product values and what that looks like in the process of creating products. So first, it's really important to start with kind of like what motivates these products and why are you creating this in the first place? And so for us, this was really about a vision we had for a THC-infused drink to be at every social occasion alongside beer and wine. You know, we named the company Can for a reason. It's that like short four-letter word that sort of describes the category. It also describes the product. It's cannabis in a can. So that really is sort of the vision, the mission that guides us through this process of creating products. The other thing that we want to not forget, in this process is the consumer. Like, who are you making these products for? That's an important part of the process as well. And so we kind of identified a few broad consumer categories, territories where we wanted to make sure that whatever product we were creating had them as an end state in mind. It's important to be careful here because, you know, consumers are helpful guideposts, but it's more of a soft nod to them. Ultimately, we want to be really true to our own product values and principles as we're creating products. They don't determine where we end up, but they help us kind of guide us to the right place. So you can see here, we have alcohol frustrated parents. This is a really key kind of focus for us. Folks who have a two-year-old waking them up at 6 in the morning, probably not a successful strategy to drink a few glasses of wine the night before. Similarly, you know, there's an interesting millennial customer of ours who's somebody that you can't really drink alcohol in their 30s like they could in their 20s. And they're also not going to slow down socially, or they're not ready to slow down socially. So thinking about how that customer sort of informs or could benefit from these products. And then we talk a little bit about the experience optimizer. This is somebody that's I'm sort of tox on generally as an approach to life. And so this is another arrow that you can put in my quiver in terms of how I want to sort of build my experience in any given social setting. Those are the consumers. That's really what leads us into this. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, values in the context of pitfalls. So often, you know, the reasons why products end up challenged from an innovation standpoint are identifiable. We can talk through them. And I've highlighted a few common ones that I'll walk you through that we really try to avoid. So the first major category that we see from folks is really this idea of the stakeholders at the table, right? So who's sitting around the table? And often products that are less innovative or less successful come out of these you know, designed by committee environments. And so we'll talk a little bit about why that doesn't always work. Another common pitfall is folks focus too much on cost and commercialization. It's obviously important. We'll talk about sort of that balance and dilemma. But if it's all you're focused on, it's going to be much harder to innovate. And then similarly, flavor and brand are afterthoughts. They're sort of things that come in. Is it good enough flavor? Is the brand, is the packaging good enough? Okay, great, let's launch it. And for obvious reasons, that doesn't work. So we'll talk a little bit about the can experience and how that sort of informs some of our thinking. So first, you know, designed by committee. Why does this not work? In some cases, it's a little bit obvious what's going on here, but you have products, you have people sitting around the table from R&D, from legal, you know, sales. Maybe there's a business development person. Maybe there's some folks from ops, and they're all kind of telling you, well, you can't do this, or you can't do that, or it needs to have this, or it needs to have this. And in doing so, you sort of like beat the creativity and the innovation and the excitement out of a product. It's not an effective strategy. You can see some of the graveyard of products of this sort of design by committee here. We'll have to follow with Joan intimately the Starry story and see if it can avoid ending up here as well. But, you know, it's not entirely clear that it will, in part because there's a formula. There's an expectation of this product to hit a bunch of different boxes. And that's really, really hard to do. It's also why you see, I think, you know, really successful brands coming out of a more innovative environment like Black Rifle, like Prime, Alani Nu. They're really starting at this early stage of innovation where they're trying to do something different, not to conform to an existing expectation that consumers have. That's a really powerful difference. Here you can see me and my co-founder. This is a fun photo. We talk a lot about in the product innovation process, designing for an N of one, or in our case, it was two. But it really means going back to what does one individual think and like. It sort of feels counterintuitive, right? Because the goal is not to sell to one individual. Ultimately, we want to, you know, these products to be commercially successful and sell to millions and millions of people across the globe. So why would we focus on starting at one? It's really important because it changes the bet, right? The bet that my co-founder Luke and I made in developing Can was a little bit different, right? We both loved the products and the flavor experience and the brand. So we're actually thinking more about, well, are there more people out there like us? And that's also ultimately the bet that we were making, not so much, you know, does somebody like this? Do they not like it? Do they think it has too much lemon or not enough rosemary? That's a losing battle. You know, one of my favorite examples of this is a product that came out of Stanford Business School where we started Can. There was a Fitbit for dogs, and everyone's like, this is an amazing idea. Let's test this in Palo Alto among all of the sort of folks in the neighborhood. And they loved it. And they said, Fitbit for dogs is an amazing idea. Interestingly, that did not really extend beyond that. There weren't a lot of people like, you know, folks in Palo Alto that are willing to spend ridiculous amounts of money on their pets and track its fitness. And so, you know, understanding that bet, that shift is an important one. It doesn't always work. Who you're testing these products on is an important factor here as well. We like to think about the highest experience customer. That's really the person that gets the most value from your products. You know, in some ways we were lucky because Luke and myself were the highest experienced customer for this product. And we were also lucky in that most people share our frustration with alcohol, and that cuts across demographics, ages, genders, all sorts of things like that. So in some ways we were lucky on that front. Can we start sort of thinking about this in an approach? And I think often the way that people approach product development is very formulaic. It's very focused on some key features of cost and commercialization, right? We're so worried that we're going to create a product that won't work from a margin standpoint, or we won't be able to bring to market. As you saw from that photo, Luke and I did most of the development work in a kitchen in the early days. You know, any smart product developer will tell you, you know, that doesn't translate. You can't just buy, you know, juices from the store or God forbid, you're, you know, freshly squeezing juice and then expecting that at an industrial scale, you'll get the same quality. You know, we kind of pushed back on that idea. We were like, let's at least start from a place of kitchen grade and see if we can create something innovative. Let's not restrict ourselves from the outset. Why does this happen, right? Like, I think it's important to nod a little bit to why these pitfalls emerge, right? Folks are driven by unit economics, right? They really want the product to work from a cost standpoint. What does that mean? What's the consequence of that? Well, they may make choices about the ingredients that don't make a ton of sense. We have Sicilian lemon juice in our product. It is delicious. It is the best lemon juice in the world. I'll challenge anybody on this point. There's something about the volcanic ash and how it changes the acidity and balance of the lemons. It's much more aromatic. But it's expensive. Are you willing to spend 5 cents more, 2 cents more, depending on how much you have in the product, for Sicilian lemon juice versus a domestic provider, which may be much cheaper? Or do you use a concentrated one, God forbid, right? Those are pressures that folks in product development, founders feel every day to make those decisions. And ultimately, it's not entirely clear that they benefit from it, because you may pay 2 cents more for that lemon juice, but you can charge a dollar more to the consumer. You can tell an ingredient heritage story that you would otherwise not be able to tell. The other big issue is to commercialization, right? How does this translate from kitchen grade to industrial scale? It's very difficult to do that. There's all sorts of examples that we've run across. Our cans are a great one, where you can't find cans at the size that you want. You've got to switch to another one back and forth. Those types of commercialization issues are really important ones. Our argument is, well, why don't we just start with something innovative and then we try to commercialize it? Worst case, we create something amazing that we can't bring to market. That's a better loss. That's a better failure than create something average that's very easily commercializable. I wanted to just point out that, there's real cost reasons why people do this. It's not kind of like obvious that you would take the risk that I'm describing and potentially bring a product to market that you can't actually make long-term work from a unit economic standpoint. So there is real risk here. You can see the incentives from not having preservatives, from using concentrated juices, from using with other natural flavors, which if you've ever had a lime with other natural flavor, it tastes nothing like lime. But it saves you money, and that's why people do it, right? Again, I think that these are pitfalls that we should avoid. The approach that we would recommend and that we deployed in working with CAN was really talking about the product values. What are those lines that you're not going to cross? Like, we really wanted to believe in these products. We weren't going to put concentrated juices in it or preservatives because it made the product taste worse. That mattered to us. It comes with trade-offs, but those were sort of the standards that we put into place and are super important to how we built these products. Flavor is an afterthought. This is, I think one of the big challenges in food and beverage product development is you end up in these situations where, you'll try products and you'll sort of say, wait, that doesn't taste that great. Or, oh, it's not supposed to taste great because it's a health product. And so consumers are willing for it to taste like a little bit off because, it has no added sugar, or it's using something like stevia, or it's keto. We threw all of that out the window. This is a product category where folks want to sip, savor, and enjoy. It's replacing alcohol. In some ways, that ritual, that experience is really important. So flavor had to be at the forefront of what we were trying to do. It became even more important. We did not go into the formulation exercise saying it has to hit this formula, like under 50 calories, no added sugar, under 10 net carbs, a blend of adaptogens, superfoods, all this stuff. Like, for the most part, those are all things that make the product taste worse. And so we threw that out the window and we really said, how do we lead with flavor? How do we say, if we don't look each other in the eyes and say, this is amazing, I want to drink this every day, then we're not there yet. We keep developing it further. You can see here some of the ingredient choices we made. I've mentioned a few of them already. We care a lot about all natural. We care about, lowering the amount of sugar, but we want that sugar to come from a real sugar source, not some sort of sugar substitute that leaves an awful mouth feeling or film on the tongue. And that's really guided our view on how to create delicious beverages. Brand, I won't spend too much time on this, but the gist here is, product is what matters. Product, product, product. If you focus only on product, you will be successful. But for a consumer brand, and especially for a beverage, brand is part of your product. A lot of times I think folks spend a ton of time getting their formulation right. They're dialing it in the kitchen. It tastes great. They're really happy with it. And then they delegate a brand exercise to an agency that happens, over the course of a few weeks. And then they say, oh, it's good enough, and we'll rush that to market. Your consumers are willing to evolve with you. There's great examples of stories of consumer products that have changed their brand and seen real positive benefits from that. So I wouldn't say, delay launching your product forever, but I do think it's really important to ask questions like, what does the brand say about somebody when they buy it? Ultimately the first thing that someone will engage on your product is the packaging, is how it sort of expresses itself. What is it saying to that consumer? So those are really important things not to forget. And there's a fun slide here if you can sort of see our brand evolution. This happened sort of over the course of 6 months, some pretty weird versions of our cans that we're very glad we landed where we ultimately did. And you know, people will come up to us at trade shows and booths and actually just say nothing but start taking pictures of the can. That's probably a good sign you're doing something special with the packaging. This is to summarize. Design for an N of one. Really think about that, that individual highest experience customer that's going to benefit the most and serve them really well. There will be others like them in the world. Lead with those product values. Know where your red lines are around what you're willing to compromise and what you're not willing to compromise. Make the product taste good, please. And don't forget brand. That ultimately is the gateway into the product experience. I will kick it back over to Jessica. I don't know if we have time for questions, but maybe one or two.
Thank you, Joan, James, and Jake for a great presentation. Before we have our presenters address some questions that have been submitted throughout the program, I wanted to remind you that we'd love your feedback in our webinar survey to help us improve our programs. So let's kick off with our first question, which Jake, you highlighted in your presentation, you know, that you guys did not make flavor an afterthought. It was very paramount to you. You know, then toward the end, we saw the transition from in your packaging. Would you say, you know, for those going forward, should packaging also and design be part of the early process? Or do you think with consumers today, you have a little bit more leeway in your packaging versus what you would have in flavor?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think you absolutely have more leeway with packaging than you do flavor. If something is gross and people want to spit it out, it doesn't matter what you do with the packaging, they're probably done. Whereas if they love the product and it's serving their needs, right? One of my favorite examples of this is RX Bar, which went through, you know, a packaging rebrand and it transformed the business by sort of just surfacing the essential ingredients of the bar. You know, there's some other great stories like that where consumers are willing to involve with you on the packaging and how the brand shows up. But they're less likely to do that if they had a bad experience with the flavor. So I would definitely start with flavor. But I would also, you know, not forget that at the end of the day, this is a brand, right? A lot of times sort of software ecosystem encourages us to just test things on the market. And I think with consumer brands, we have to be a little bit more careful because everything about that package is signaling something to the consumer. And it's what they actually interact with first. So if you're going to use the packaging to draw folks in and get them to try the product, it has to be really strong.
Great. And then, Joan, you mentioned brands with success in transforming an existing category. And there you kind of highlighted some brands that have had success in carbonated soft drinks and beer. Are we seeing any other beverage categories that are having that same sort of transformation in breaking from the traditional existing aspects?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I also mentioned it in breakfast in taking cereal, like cereal, for example, has been very transformative because the actual breakfast cereal, those sales are declining. The consumption is declining. So what those companies are doing is trying to figure out new occasions or where their brand might fit. And part of it is in beverages. You know, it's, again, these are very nostalgic brands that are being miniaturized and thrown into yogurt or used as an ice cream topping or made into beverages. So it's trying to figure out, I would say, rather than upending a given category, it's just trying to find new occasions, new ways of formulating a product or a brand to fit a new occasion and then getting it out there. One thing that I'll point out is that a lot of new products are, you know, people experiment with new products because they're familiar with the brand. So moving into a new category is a pretty decent strategy for a brand that's already achieved success in one area of the store.
Great. And then, James, can you expand a bit on the best practices for online A/B testing? You know, testing matrices can, you know, be very complex. So how can we keep it as simple as possible and still get actionable data without spinning our wheels, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think a lot of times when you're looking to figure out whether or not something's working, it's kind of hard to determine, one, how to move forward with that, but also what are the variables that you're going to test. If you're looking to really implement A/B testing properly, is to have kind of an hypothesis that you're working towards. One of these two options is going to be more effective than the other, and I want to know which one it's supposed to be. A lot of the energy, a lot of the focus, a lot of the investment that's made on, let's say, option A, should have the weight behind it, some data initially to support that claim, so that when you have a variable B, you're able to make sure that you're moving in the right direction. Any data is good data to help inform your decision-making process on whether or not something that you're pursuing as a strategy is going to work or if it needs to be modified and changed. And I think specifically in this sphere, consumers are going to let you know pretty much in real time as much as they can whether or not there is something that is working or not.
Wonderful. Well, that is all the time we have for questions today. Please join me in thanking Joan Driggs, James Weiss, and Jake Bullock for their presentation, as well as our sponsors, Cargill and Brothers International. If you have any additional questions or comments, please don't hesitate to click the email us button on the console. Please visit www.bevindustry.com/webinars for the archive of this presentation, as well as information about our upcoming events. We appreciate your time and hope you found this webinar to be a valuable experience.